Gildan Media presents Your Coach in a Box, affordable, life-changing audio programs.
The Little Book of the Shrinking Dollar. What You Can Do to Protect Your Money Now, by Addison Wiggin with Samantha Bucher, read by Joe Jeffrey. Introduction. What if the power of money were in your hands? Sounding the alarm about the U.S. dollar. If you picked up this audio program, you realize the dollar isn't worth what it used to be. It's not just your Great Depression-era relative saying it. If we go back to just the 1970s, when I was but a humble toddler, the dollar was worth a lot more. What happened? Well, that's what this little book will tell you, with plenty of ways you can save the value of what you earn and even profit from the upheaval that dollar decline promises ahead. Why am I so sure of the ultimate fate of the U.S. dollar? One simple fact. It's just paper. Every paper currency in the history of civilization has eventually lost its entire value. That's not to say there won't be many stops along the way, pauses where the dollar rises against most major currencies. However, today's situation is more urgent than ever because a paper currency that doesn't pay its holders a positive real interest rate tends to lose value at an accelerating rate. That describes the U.S. dollar and most other currencies today. The velocity of dollar shrinkage has all the hallmarks of going into hyperdrive. But we won't know for sure the hour or the time. We don't know who will be in the White House when it happens or who will be the Fed Reserve Chair. But when the powers that be kick the final legs out from the stool propping up the dollar, the crash will be rapid. That's why I'm writing this audio program, to prepare you for whatever lies ahead. There are moves you can put in place right now that can turn a profit in a week, some in 6 months, some in 3 years, and some are plain, good, long-term insurance that you can pass on to your children. Here's how it begins. The whole basis for money itself, currency as a means of commerce, is based on tangible value. In other words, money is not the greenbacks we carry around. It is supposed to be the gold or other metal backing it up. The dollar is a promissory note. Check what it says at the top of the bill itself, Federal Reserve Note. Today, the American dollars in circulation are just a bunch of IOUs. That would be fine if the gold reserves were sitting in Fort Knox to back up those IOUs, but they're not. The Fed just keeps printing more and more money, and it will eventually catch up with us. The day will come when we have to pay off those IOUs, not only domestically, but to our ever-expanding foreign investors, too. The funny money game. History shows that money, official money printed by the government, has been known to lose value and become virtually worthless. Think back. 50 million mark bills from 1920s Germany, Russian rubles from pre-revolution days, or Cuban pesos pre-Castro. In all these times and places, jarring political and economic changes destroyed currency values suddenly, completely, and permanently. We are not as insulated as many Americans believe. What kinds of events could do the same thing to the U.S. dollar? What can you do today to position yourself strategically? There's plenty, which we'll explore in this audiobook. In fact, the potential fall of the dollar can be good news, if you know what steps to take today. Remember, a riverboat gambler who keeps asking for even higher markers will eventually run out of credit. At some point, the casino boss will realize that the gambler's ability to repay is questionable. Maybe those markers are just a heap of IOUs that can never be cashed in. It all began for us in 1971. When the United States removed its currency from the gold standard, it seemed to make economic sense at the time. President Nixon saw this as the solution to a range of economic problems, and, combined with wage and price freezes, printing as much money as desired looked like a good idea. Unfortunately, most of the world's currencies followed suit. The world economy now runs primarily on a fiat money system, backed by nothing but air. Fiat money is so called because it is not backed by any tangible asset. That would be gold or silver. Heck, even seashells would be a better backing than the government's word for it. Instead, we must rely on the government's decree that this money is a legal exchange medium, and it is worth what we say. So, lacking a gold backing or backing of some other precious metal, what gives the currency value? Is there a special reserve somewhere? No. Some economists have tried to explain away the problems of fiat money by pointing to the vast wealth of the United States in terms of productivity, natural resources, and land. But even if those assets are counted, they're not liquid. They're not part of the system of exchange. Here's a simple rule. Fiat money holds its value only as long as the people using that money continue to believe it has value, and as long as they continue to find people who will accept the currency in exchange for goods and services. The value of fiat money relies on confidence and expectation. So as we continue to increase our deficit bubbles, and as long as consumer debt keeps rising, our fiat money will eventually lose value. Gold, in comparison, has tangible value based on real market forces of supply and demand. The short-term effect of converting from the gold standard to fiat money has been widespread prosperity. So the overall impression is that the U.S. monetary policy has created and sustained this prosperity. Why abandon the dollar when times are so good? Yet things aren't as good right now. This is where the great monetary trap is found. If we study the many economic bubbles in effect today, we know we will eventually have to face up to the excesses and that a big correction will occur. That means the dollar will fall and gold's value will rise as a direct result. The sad lesson of economic history will be that when the gold standard is abandoned and when governments can print too much money, they will. That tendency is a disaster for any economic system, because excess money in circulation, too much debt, in other words, only encourages consumer behavior mirroring that policy. Thus, we find ourselves in record high levels of credit card debt, refinanced mortgages, and personal bankruptcies, all connected to that supposed prosperity based on printing far too much currency, the fiat system. Whenever governments are granted the power to purchase their own debt, they never fail to do so, eventually destroying the value of the currency. Political money always fails because free people eventually reject it. Dr. Ron Paul, The Case for Gold. We can see where this overprinting will lead. Like a Tiananmen Square Rolex watch deal, the value simply isn't there. In case you don't believe me, consider history. Emperor Augustus started taking Rome down the slippery slope of decline back in 20 BC. He started printing money faster than the gold could be produced to back it. He had the mines running 24 hours a day at the edges of the empire. Every emperor after followed suit. Nero wanted to continue the spending parade, mounting ever larger trade deficits between Rome and its colonies and trading partners. About 1,100 years ago, China began the paper money experiment. They called it flying money because a breeze could blow it out of a holder's hand. It was supposed to be a temporary fix during a copper shortage, but the paper money system got out of control. You see, it was all too easy to just keep printing, which led to uncontrolled inflation. As bad an idea as it was, Marco Polo took some paper money back to Europe, where few people believed his tall tales of Chinese paper money. But a few hundred years later, the Europeans were ready to try their own paper money experiment. When Spain found gold in Mexico in the 16th century, it became the world's richest nation. The Spanish used the gold to buy, and to expand their military influence. But the wars eventually used up their wealth, so Spain began issuing debt to pay the bills, leading to loss of its economic and military power. The French went through a similar period in the 18th century, printing way too much money and suffering unbelievable levels of inflation. That's thanks to excessive debt and a national bankruptcy. I'm sure you're starting to sense a pattern. Runaway money printing leads to massive inflation and worthless currency. Perhaps the worst monetary collapse of the 20th century was the so-called Weimar Republic. To handle post-World War I war reparations, the temporary government began printing massive amounts of currency to make payments. The currency became worthless. The resulting devastation paved the way for the Nazi movement and ushered in World War II. The last time money was worth something. The year was 1944. For the first time in modern history, an international agreement was reached to govern monetary policy among nations. It was, significantly, a chance to create a stabilizing international currency and ensure monetary stability once and for all. In total, 730 delegates from 44 nations met for 3 weeks in July that year at a hotel resort in Brenton Woods, New Hampshire. It was a significant opportunity, but it fell short of what could have been achieved. It was a turning point in monetary history, however. The result of this international meeting, the Bretton Woods Accord, had the original purpose of rebuilding after World War II through a series of currency stabilization programs and infrastructure loans to war-ravaged nations. By 1946, the system was in full operation through the newly established International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the IBRD, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, IMF. What makes the Bretton Woods Accord so interesting to us today is the fact that the whole plan for international monetary policy was based on nations agreeing to adhere to a global gold standard. Each country signing the agreement promised to maintain its currency at values within a narrow margin to the value of gold. The IMF was established to facilitate payment imbalances on a temporary basis. This system worked for 25 years. But it was flawed in its underlying assumptions. By pegging international currency to gold at $35 an ounce, it failed to take into consideration the change in gold's actual value since 1934, when the $35 level had been set. The dollar had lost substantial purchasing power during and after World War II, and as European economies built back up, the ever-growing drain on U.S. gold reserves doomed the Bretton Woods Accord's chances as a permanent working system. Now keep in mind that the United States owned 80% of the world's gold reserves at the time. So the United States had every motive to agree to the use of the gold standard to organize world currencies and to create and encourage free trade. The gold standard evolved over a period of hundreds of years, planned by a central bank, government, or committee of business leaders. The concept was a good one. However, in practice, the international currency naturally became the U.S. dollar. And other nations pegged their currencies to the dollar rather than to the value of gold. The actual outcome of Bretton Woods was to replace the gold standard with the dollar standard. Once the United States linked the dollar to gold at a value of $35 per ounce, the whole system fell into place, at least for a while. Since the dollar was convertible to gold, and other nations pegged their currencies to the dollar, it created a pseudo-gold standard. But that's where the trouble starts. How the dollar really works. How do you define the worth of any commodity? Supply and demand. As demand increases, the price rises. That's efficiency. But when paper money comes into use, the whole efficiency of the economic system goes out the window. That's because the government can print money with a few keystrokes out of thin air. So the money supply can continue to expand regardless of the real demand. It can even do so under a gold standard system, disregarding the supply of gold itself. That's how paper money undoes itself and becomes worthless. We've seen it happen time and again, from ancient Rome to China to colonial Spain to Germany, and now the United States. Perhaps a paper money system pegged specifically to commodity reserves would give the currency the stability it needs and rein in government spending. The bottom line here is that the government is like a hungry fat man at an all-you-can-eat buffet, only with less discipline. They are simply going to print, print, print until the system fails. Never before in human history has the reserve currency of the world been so burdened with debt. I write this knowing I said the same thing in 2008. It's only gotten worse. And never has the transfer of one international currency to another been peaceful. In 2008, we wondered, could the euro unseat the dollar? As we'll see further on, that's becoming increasingly unlikely for the same reasons that the dollar can't hold its value. There's just as much a chance that the new world reserve currency will be the Chinese yuan. But as we pointed out above, A government-controlled currency is as good as dead. It's just a matter of time. Statist governments love to interfere and control the market. They found it necessary to eliminate the gold standard. They'll refuse to return to that kind of stability as long as they think they can get away with it. So we soldier on under the price controls on the very symbol of our economic freedom, the U.S. dollar itself. Addison Wiggin, February 21, 2012. Chapter 1. Dollar Decline. How did we get here? Think the dollar hasn't declined? It has lost 80% of its purchasing power since 1970, the year before the great experiment of cutting the dollar loose from a fixed value in gold. Back in 1970, if you just stashed a dollar coin under the mattress, today you'd find it buys you less than 2 dimes worth of goods. That doesn't even cover the price of a postage stamp or a can of Coke. It's practically worthless. Our currency is in a turbulent flux that's gotten worse and worse as the decades march on. Today's dollar purchases 5 cents of what it purchased in the 1930s. Think that's too far back? Consider the 1980s. Today's dollar purchases only 50 cents of what it did back then. But there will be critics who tell you that the purchasing power isn't the only measure of currency strength. Dollar's popularity doesn't protect it. The U.S. Continental Congress created the U.S. dollar by an act of its own power in 1785. They hoped it would compete with the Spanish currency, which was the popular legal tender at the time. Sure enough, here we are in 2012, and the U.S. dollar is now a victim of its own success. It's America's most successful export ever. More successful than Levi's, chewing gum, or Coca-Cola. No export is more popular. Let's look at the hard numbers. Approximately 2/3 of U.S. dollars are held outside of the United States. 85% of global trade is made with the U.S. dollar, but all that stands to change. I think the role of the U.S. dollar as the world's primary reserve currency will be gone in a decade. The foundation of our financial franchise, the U.S. dollar brand, is trust. That's trust in our determination not to debase the world's primary exchange mechanism, the world's primary store of liquid wealth. We no longer deserve the trust and are rapidly debasing the brand. Rick Rule, Sprott Asset Management. The euro is the second most popular currency in the world's beauty pageant, although it's taking a pretty ugly beating as we enter 2012. Still, about 26% of the world's monetary reserves holdings are denominated in this 17-nation currency. We'll cover the details in later chapters, but for now, let's look at a few tremors we've tracked that predict an earthquake ahead for the U.S. dollar. The old lady of Threadneedle Street to USA. You're toast. Let me introduce you to my friend Ralph Benko of the American Principles Project. We first met at the Watershed October 2011 Heritage Foundation Conference on the stable dollar, why we need it, and how to achieve it. At the end of 2011, Ralph told Forbes readers, "The World Dollar Standard's death certificate arrives in the mail this week." He's referring to a paper issued officially on December 20, 2011, by the old lady of Threadneedle Street, a.k.a. the Bank of England. The Bank of England, as you can guess from the nickname, is the staid, prosaic, conservative bunch on the block of central bankers. So it's no surprise this working paper hides its revelation under the dull title, Reform of the International Monetary and Financial System. But here's the dollar bomb. The world was better off when the world's currencies were tied to the dollar, and the dollar was tied to gold, however tenuously. To understand the dollar's future, it's important to understand the dollar's past. By now, we have a vast cornucopia of dollar-denominated debt securities. The scale of these markets is unprecedented. The bigger the market, the lower the spreads it can offer, making deals here the most attractive. There are also plenty of ways to hedge dollar exchange rate risk, which will be part of the solution set you'll learn about in this book. It's the reason why everyone from corporations to governments and central banks consider it a great currency for doing business. Finally, it's a safe haven that benefits from there being a lack of superliquid high-volume alternatives. Australia, for instance, has recently made a reputation for stability, but it simply accounts for too small a slice of global financial transactions. So, basically, the U.S. dollar just happens to be winning the beauty contest among the ugliest world currencies. Another friend, resource expert Rick Rule, agrees. The only reason, he says, we still enjoy the status that we enjoy globally and the benefits of seniorage is that other societies have proven even better at debasement than we have. Basing your brand on the attribute of being the least bad has been a consistently faulty strategy. How do you know when your branding campaign isn't working? When consumers start buying from your competitors in increasing numbers. The same principle is at work with currencies. Increasingly, we'll have to compete for our dollars to be used, bought, and saved. Here's an early sign. Russia and Iran are ditching the dollar. The two countries will carry out their trade with each other using rubles and rials. Add that to the list. China and Russia abandoned the greenback as their bilateral trade more than a year ago. The big rumble is that the Middle East will follow suit. Imagine if they no longer trade oil in U.S. dollars. It won't just be Iran as some alternative bores. Plans are at work for Gulf states cooperation, including Saudi Arabia and Abu Dhabi. This shouldn't be too surprising, given that the United Nations itself has called for a new global reserve currency. Why? They say it's dangerous to allow us the privilege of building up our massive trade deficit. Pretty soon, says Everbank's currency guru Chuck Butler, having the reserve currency of the world isn't going to be such a big thing if all the commodity trade isn't settled in dollars. Chuck is definitely in the camp that questions the safe haven currency status the dollar holds. He doesn't blame any country for wanting to remove dollars from their reserves. After all, the dollars have lost so much value over the years. Sure, he points out, it is the most liquid currency in the world, but if countries keep taking dollars out of the terms of their trade, how much longer can it remain the most liquid currency? It's a real conundrum that any dollar earner and investor needs to be aware of. It doesn't mean we'll lose the world's preferred currency status today, tomorrow, or even next year. Eventually, though, there will come a time when the world's nations will stop adding U.S. dollars to their already swollen coffers. They'll demand something else instead. We would argue, like the old lady of Threadneedle Street, for something that looks a lot more like Bretton Woods. We're betting other nations, especially the gold-hoarding ones we'll explore in later chapters, would totally agree. Let's put a period on this by ending with a comment from England's central bank researchers. The Bretton Woods era stands out as coinciding with remarkable financial stability and sustained high growth at a global level. Sounds pretty nice, doesn't it? They go on. The solid growth outcomes were not simply the result of post-war reconstruction efforts. They say that, in fact, GDP growth was actually stronger in the 1960s than it was in the 1950s. Makes you wonder, what went wrong? Chapter 2. Serial Bubble Blowers. Who controls our economic destiny? The shrinking dollar is a modern problem. The U.S. dollar has been shrinking since the inception of the Federal Reserve, the very crew assigned the task of maintaining its value. Of late, the decline is accelerating at an alarming rate. For many Americans, the suggestion that the dollar is losing value is unthinkable, even unpatriotic. The problem is not simply a lack of understanding about the nature of wealth and investment used to sustain it. Our policymakers and economists make no distinction between wealth created through savings and investment in the real economy versus wealth created in the markets through asset bubbles brought about by credit policies. When I tell people this, I feel like I'm addressing a meeting of folks who want to lose weight at the local burger joint. We as individuals, and as a nation, are addicted to cheap, easy credit. What the government gives, we'll take. We spend at a high level, and we want to accumulate wealth on the same fast track. Forget hard work. We'd rather our house go up in value like magic. Traditionally, economists recognized that it took time to build an estate. People and countries could build wealth slowly. Those days are far, far behind us. Now we are at the mercy of what I call serial bubble blowers. All the U.S. economy's so-called improvements stem from one main reason. All economic growth during the recovery since 2001 can be traced to a seemingly endless array of asset and borrowing bubbles. First, we saw the stock market bubble, then the bond bubble, then the housing bubble, then the mortgage refinance bubble, then the commodities bubble. Now, another bond bubble approaches. In between, we haven't seen a single sign of stable, sustained growth. And that makes sense. Consumer spending has been surging in excess of disposable income for years. That's not real growth. Right now, Washington thinks that another round of stimulus will solve the problem. That's like saying that overeating will eventually lead to serious dieting. Consumer spending isn't juicing the economy. Meanwhile, since the government is broke, all the borrowing they do to fund stimulus, tax cuts, and anything else to save the economy puts us at the mercy of foreign investors. If and when they decide to slash their investments in U.S. dollars or Treasury securities, we'll have a crash landing worse than anything we've seen yet. It'll be far worse than Lehman Brothers' collapse, far worse than 2008's aftermath. We depend on foreign investors for everything, be they private, institutional, or governmental. We need them. If the dollar's fall frightens foreign investors, they will sell from this immense stock of dollar assets. But how big are these foreign holdings? You rarely hear about this on financial news channels, so you probably don't think it's a big deal. In fact, it's a big fat deal. We're sitting on $15.4 trillion in debt. How's it going to get paid? And by whom? Back before 1970, foreigners held a 5% slice of U.S. public debt. Today, foreigners hold nearly half the pie. And the government owes a bunch of it to itself, $4.6 trillion, including what it's borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund. Is Washington at all alarmed? While the end of 2011 did culminate in near-monthly government shutdown threats, we expect the debt ceiling to go on being raised as it was under every presidency since, 1917, when we had a world war to finance. At last count, it's been raised 74 times. And lest you believe the crisis came to a head in the Obama administration, we'd like to point out that he's only raised it 3 times so far. Famed fiscal conservative Ronald Reagan raised it a whopping 18 times. So you see, borrowing to spend is everyone's favorite game. Darn all the consequences. Why isn't all this intervention working? As usual, the hope is that a cheaper dollar makes exports cheaper and reduces our trade deficit. A nice thought, of course, but past experience shows that this is unlikely. What's the real cause of the trade deficit? Chronically high levels of undersaving and underinvestment. The catch is that everything the Fed is doing right now only encourages 2 things, undersaving and underinvestment. When you monkey with interest rates the way the Fed is wont to do, you're able to send false signals to potential investors and savers. In essence, the Fed is telling you that you don't know what to do with your own money. To them, you're an individual who's too stupid to know what's best. They don't think you can safely and simply buy the goods and services you need or want when and as you need or want them. To get out of the dot-com hangover, the Fed redirected our attention to housing. By offering us ever lower interest rates, they encouraged mortgage borrowing on an unprecedented scale. On cue, they allowed 2 near-bankrupt public agencies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to huddle under government's protective wing. These guys are worse than pawn shop brokers. Yet they pretend to enable the American dream. And besides, why would you put aside money to save for a house when your next-door neighbor is offered a no-money-down loan with an adjustable rate in a much better neighborhood than you ever dreamed you could afford? Banks get way more money off that kind of deal, as long as the party lasts.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?